this story goes way beyond tech. I mean, I was thinking about it this morning, talking about the significance of artificial
human
light
evolution.
To civilization. I mean, if we didn't have artificial light, we would not be doing this show.
No, we could. There's,
we
it
would
be
sleeping in. Is what we would be
absolutely.
Doing. Absolutely. That's right. And, you know, we should actually put a picture on the website.
There you go. Bad idea.
We should put a picture on the website. I mean, they've put these black
curtains
over the window where we used to be able to see the sunrise in the studio.
Right.
Every morning at 10 of 6, I've got to go out and look at the sky because it actually freaks me out biologically that we're now in
that
this lightless room.
It,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, Jane Brocks understands the significance of artificial light. She wrote the book on the subject, Brilliant, The Evolution of Artificial Light. She joins us from Brunswick, Maine, where the light is pretty pathetic there in the winter, right, Jane?
It is. 9 hours or so.
Is that what got you interested in this subject? It's a fascinating book.
Well, actually, no. I grew up on a farm, and I was interested in the subject of rural electrification. But when I started doing the backstory research for it, I was just astonished at what I was turning up.
Well, rural electrification was a transformative moment for people all over the United States. But you really can separate, and you do in this book, civilization into two components, the quest for artificial light and the having of artificial light. First of all, the quest. How long did it go on?
Oh, it went on for thousands and thousands of years. Actually, before the late 18th century, since the cave dwellers who drew on the walls of Lascaux, people lived by essentially the same light, a candle or a lamp that gave off very little light. There had been no technological evolution in light until the end of the 18th century.
What were the innovative attempts to try to get around this serious problem of not having anything other than a candle at night?
Well, some people magnified the light with mirrors. Those were mostly the wealthy. Some people would magnify it with water, would have globes of water and use the water to magnify the glass. But a lot of people simply couldn't afford a lot of light. I mean, at times before the introduction of mineral oils, all fuel for light could also be used for food.
Hmm.
And sometimes it was a choice between do we see or do we eat.
That's a fascinating. I mean, the place where you decide whether you want to have light is also the place where you decide whether you're going to eat or not. Competition for food and light. How did that change our brains when we got away from that?
Well, how did it change our brains? I think that once we got away from that, the further we got away from that, we began to take light for granted. We began to separate light from sort of the grime of the getting. You know, once at the beginning, people would find their own fuels, and it was very localized. And if you were in the Mediterranean, you would use olive oil. If you were in the Shetland Islands, you would use storm petrels for your candles. You would put a wick down the throat of the storm petrel, the dead storm petrel, and light it up. So, but we've gotten far away from that, and we don't really, we're separated from the source, I guess.
How did cities change when light was available at all hours?
Well, cities in the Middle Ages, fortified cities would just lock down at night because there were no police forces at the time. There was no way of keeping order except to keep people in their homes. And in some places, people were even locked into their houses at night, and the keys were given over to authorities. And they would put chains across the roads. They would lock the fortified gates. And as light grew and grew, as street lights became more prominent, then it opened up, I call it a new hour for the human spirit, because people were able to go out at night. People had this free time after dark. In the 19th century, it became a time to just go out and window shop or to go into the taverns and coffee houses and that sort of thing. And that just didn't exist for people before street lighting.
But you know, that feeling of safety and the eradication of fear of the dark sustains us even now, just knowing that the light is there when the lights aren't on. I'm thinking of the years I spent in Flagstaff, Arizona, where they have light pollution ordinances, which means that in a lot of places they just turn the lights off at night and it's dark, really dark. And I enjoy it.
Well, that's what one of my hopes for the book is, to just have people think more and more about light. I think we do have too much light now. Light pollution is a serious problem. As the light that once satisfied the 19th century people would not be enough for us. Mm. You know, we've grown accustomed to more and more light. So I think it's a process of having to think about our light and think strategically about our light.
And much of the world still has to do that. I mean, there's this great story of when MIT tried to develop this laptop for kids, the $90 laptop. When they tried it out in some communities in South Asia or somewhere, I remember, the parents used it as a light source, and that was much more transformative than anything the computer itself could do.
Right. It's true. I mean, we take light for granted here, but a third of the world still does not have electrical grids, so does not have a constant, you know, reliable source of power. And that's a real challenge for the modern age, because it does, as in rural electrification in the 30s, it does make a difference in just the inequality of life people being able to have a chance.
As we become, Jane, as we become more conscious of our energy choices and the problems of, maybe we don't have unlimited amounts of energy, do you think we're headed back to a time when we ration light, where we embrace the dark, and maybe some of these class distinctions that you write about in the book are going to return?
I hope not. I hope rather that we find a better grid in which to deliver power and more efficient light sources, but also that people come to an understanding that light becomes more and more democratic across the globe, but that people just come to an understanding that maybe we might be more hampered by our brilliance than our ancestors ever were by the dark.
Well, that sounds...
We come to understand what dark means and what our light means.
Well, it's very eloquent.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Would you give up light at night? Would you give it up?
I wouldn't give it up, but I would certainly reduce it, and I do try to.
And,
I have a street light shining in my bedroom. So.
which is annoying, and not enough light to write a book by, but you managed to produce Brilliant, The Evolution of Artificial Life, a terrific story of civilization's love affair with light and its loss of the darkness. Jane Brox, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All morning long, we're talking about life without different thing. Lights, we just talked about life without light and life without LeBron, possibly in Cleveland, all of the birds heading to the Gulf. So we want you to keep this conversation going. Tell us something you cannot live without and maybe something you wouldn't miss.
This is Mark from Westport, Massachusetts. I thought it was rather ironic the moment you asked whether or not we could live without whatever, we had a power outage. It was pretty funny. So, yeah, for a short time, I can.
Yeah, I've got the button right on my desk here. I can press it, and the power goes out in Westport.
Power outages at this point are kind of fun. My son loves them. Turns on the flashlights. Reach us with your stories of what you could live without and what you could or couldn't live without at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org.